And that was the theme from Braveheart. And today on this, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on the show today is Chuck Tompkins. And welcome, Chuck. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be back.
And today, Chuck is on the show as a recipient of the Multi-Faith World Award, which is a big, fancy, maybe overly big name for an award that's given locally, annually, by Area Congregations Together and Shared Journeys to recognize people who work across differences, differences of economic class, culture, race, religion, differences in values, so that we can still find a way to function as a community. And that is the point of Area Congregations Together and Shared Journeys Award, is to celebrate those who help us to function more effectively as a community. And Chuck, thank you for doing that, and thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for your graciousness, Eric, in providing that award, and it's just a privilege to receive it, and I thank you.
The so, Chuck, what we do here is try to get to know the people in the county and a little bit about them, what they do, why, how they've changed, what they do to kind of sustain themselves. And I'm wondering, I know you're known to many, but I'd like for you, in your own words, just, you know, who are you? You know, tell me a bit about yourself. Give us a thumbnail sketch in a couple of minutes about who you are.
It's an interesting question when you raise the question who you are versus what do you do.
Uh-huh. And I intentionally frame it that way.
Yeah, and whenever I ask someone that same question, I know it results in a pause, because we're accustomed, particularly as men, to answer the question with the what instead of the who. So I would simply start at the beginning by saying, who am I? I am a man. I am a father. I am a husband. I'm a grandfather. And I think that I'm a community member. I'm an encourager. And I think that as I've done some temperament analysis tests and so on, that probably I rank high, along with my wife Anne, as encouragers. And I would say that that's probably a signature of our lives together. One of my greatest thrills is to simply come alongside someone else, regardless of age, and to tap into what are their dreams, what are their desires, what are their passions, what do they desire to do in life, and to connect with them at a deep level and simply facilitate and encourage them on their journey. Mm-hmm. And so I think the who question, in a very simple way, is that's an answer that I would provide. And whether it's working with students at IC or Cornell or community members, whoever it is, I simply enjoy connecting with persons at a heart level, if there is permission granted, and to tap into their dreams and desires and encourage them in how God has wired them and designed them and move them along.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that is the most analytically abstract answer anyone has given to that question, but you give me a person behind that, which is also someone who will be with you on the journey, to use the shared mm-hmm. journeys rhetoric here. I think it also speaks to that posture is, when I asked you to be on the show, you were a little reluctant, because this is not about flying a flag. It's not about a cause. You don't have any agenda to beat here, except to help this community along in a number of ways where it may be limping, or it could walk a little better. Mm-hmm. And the word that others and that I have used to describe you is one of humility. And if you are going to be an encourager, you can't get out ahead of the people you're encouraging. Mm-hmm. And what I'm wondering is, you know, how have you learned that role? It takes oftentimes some maturity to kind of come to accept that about yourself in a culture that's driven by the signs of success. How did you come to see yourself as an encourager?
That's a good question. I don't think I've got really a defined answer for you, Eric. Mm-hmm. I think it probably calls for some fairly significant self-introspection. I doubt that it's something that I was necessarily born with, though I think that my family DNA is one of encouragers, or those who really delight in coming alongside others. But I think that it's been a journey for me. As I've progressed and now at this age, just continue to work on, and how or why I'd really be hard pressed to to understand that, except that it is. I appreciate your affirmation, and I think that probably it's just I like to believe that it may be the work of God's grace in me over the years that has tempered my characteristic pride or desire to excel and to cultivate it. And I think it's a matter of age. Of the older I get, the more I know I don't know. And my education was surely postgraduate school. And I think the more I'm around others, the more I recognize that I've got a contribution to make, but it's simply a part of a larger mosaic. So there's, and I take seriously the ethic that the Old Testament prophet exhorts when he says to walk humbly. That's what the Lord requires of us. And so to walk humbly and to love justice and so on is a part of what I desire to be as I walk this journey. So I like to believe that it's a part of the transformation of who I am into what God is designing me to become. And I seek to submit to His Spirit each day and to walk that journey by faith.
Right. And what I think we'll come back to that question, because over the course of the hour, there may be things that come up as relevant. I just want to set that out there early because I want to frame it in that context of learning how to be present to but not leading in some things that are very important. What brought you to Ithaca? What brought you to this area? I mean, Chuck Tompkins, Tompkins County, I mean.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm sure there's some connection on that family tree. I'm not sure. There's some rascals on that tree and probably a few good people. So I'll go on the trees, on the branches where the good people are. But I came here somewhat reluctantly. I was pastoring a church up in the Syracuse area. And I knew some of the folks who were down here in Ithaca, and they simply asked me if I would come down and do some pulpit supply work at a church that was without a pastor, Bethel Grove Bible Church. So I came down for four consecutive Sundays, and the second Sunday I was here, I looked out on these wide range of ages and students and community members and thought, wow, I could really thrive in this place. I just loved it. And one thing led to another, and over a year later, an invitation was issued for us to come here. And so to become pastor of Bethel Grove Bible Church was the reason why I came from Syracuse. And we had 20 delightful years of ministry there until I felt led to leave there about 9 years ago. But that was the catalyst of bringing me here to Ithaca.
And like so many people, you moved into Ithaca, you know, for a job. And joined the throngs who've done that over the last six decades. But you stayed after you moved on to another form of ministry. What is it that keeps you here now?
I think relationships. I've used the phrase many times that I've got rich social capital here in this community. And I think that, and there's a number of us in pastoral ministry as well as in the community that have got some shared longevity, and we often celebrate the richness of being in a community for a long time. A lot of reasons for that, but I think that after I left the church, there were some other opportunities that were given to me, but I just had a sense that God had still a purpose for us to remain here, and so we graciously have had great relationships with friends at the church, but beyond. And I'm grateful that being out of one particular church has enabled me to be a part of and to share in the ministry of other churches in the area and to share that great relationship with pastoral leaders and with others in churches, respective of labels or denominations, and across the aisle, so to speak, whether it be evangelical or mainline or otherwise. And that richness has just continued to be a part of the fabric of our lives. So I'm grateful for the opportunity of serving on both campuses and almost like an informal chaplaincy role, as well as with other organizations here, nonprofits. And I thoroughly enjoy just mentoring roles with persons of different ages. So it's a very diverse ministry calling at this point, complemented by bivocational, doing mm-hmm. some painting on the side. So right. it's been an interesting shift of emphases for
right,
me.
Right, right. You went from full-time pastor to part-time kind of community chaplain.
Yeah.
What did you call it? You call it pastor without portfolio or pastor
without... Pastor without walls.
Without walls, yeah. And also painting houses. I mean, I know what that's like, too. One of the things that you do you want to describe some of the groups that you work with, some of the issues that you care about and the groups that you work with locally? Because I don't know if people know how the array of contexts with which your work touches.
Yeah, there's a number of organizations that I work with. I work with a number of the staff up at Cornell who lead the different Christian organizations, mm-hmm. such as Crusade or... they now call themselves Crew, Navigators, InterVarsity, Asian Christian Fellowship, and so on, Christian Union. So I meet weekly with all those staff for a time of prayer, and that's always mm-hmm. a rich time of debriefing what God is doing on the campus and sharing in one another's lives. I've also had the privilege of serving on the board of Protestant Ministries up at Ithaca College mm-hmm. and getting to know James Touchton, the chaplain there, as well as the other board members and what's happening at IC. I've been a part of the Racker Center for a number of decades, having served as a board member and now as one of the emeritus directors. And that continues to just be a delightful experience. I'm so impressed with the caliber of that organization and the work that they carry on in our three-county area. And so that's been a privilege to share in that work and to work with their staff. Had the opportunity of even painting in some of their residences and getting to know the residents as well as the staff mm-hmm. workers. And so that's been an opportunity to serve in that capacity and to be a part of an organization that's just got a stellar reputation here in mm-hmm. town. And as I even said to somebody this morning, the kind of population, many of whom they deal with special needs, children and adults, that when Jesus said, inasmuch as you've done unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. And to be a part of an organization that takes seriously that ethic and how, regardless of their faith perspective, but treating all persons with dignity and with respect, mm-hmm. Many of them incapable of responding back, has been nothing but admiration for the staff who serve them. So to come alongside that organization and to be a part of it has been a privilege. I serve with Community Faith Partners, and in recent months, we spun off an advisory committee called the Second Wind Cottage Project. And that has had some media coverage, which we're grateful for, and strong community support as Carmen Giddy's vision of moving persons out of the jungle and into what is going to be transitional housing up in Newfield has taken root. And we'll be having that open house on December 1st up there. But that's just been a remarkable community involvement, and so it's been a privilege to share in that and all the implications of Community Faith Partners, as well as now our Second Wind Cottage Project and, right. and how that has taken hold.
And then briefly, Community Faith Partners has a number of different activities it's involved in. Could you just kind of line them out a little
bit? Yeah, our main one is really Holistic Hardware, which Cal Walker and others conduct up at the jail. We have a team of folks who are up there weekly having Bible study with the men, as well as a group of women who meet with the women. And so there is significant inroads of ministry with those who desire Bible study up mm-hmm. at the jail, and then working with them when they transition out of the jail, and if they desire through Holistic Hardware or relationships of finding housing, jobs, mm-hmm. whatever is necessary to put them back into mainstream.
Now, Holistic Hardware, what is that?
Holistic Hardware was started by Cornell alum Joe Holland a number of years ago, who left here, went on to Harvard Law School, and developed then, after he left there and doing some state positions, founded Hark Homes in Harlem, New York. And that is a toolkit that Joe calls of developing life skills. Mm-hmm. And Cal Walker has been doing that for a number of years and has seen remarkable success with persons of developing life skills of how to handle wealth, how to handle your time, and how to handle friends and relationships, associations. So different tools that are in our toolbox which help us become better citizens and better members of the community. So Cal has done that along with now a team of others, And they meet three times at three different locations during the course of the week. And now they're also working with Court Street Place, which is run by the Rescue Mission. And some of those men are involved in the course, as well as those who have come out of the jail, as well as other community members.
Right.
So that's been really a positive thing.
And would you say the majority of these men and women are churched or unchurched?
Unchurched.
Yes. And, yep. and what do you feel makes them feel comfortable with Community Faith Partners?
Well, I think that Holistic Hardware particularly is though it is faith-based, it is not faith in your face. it is simply an engaging way of looking holistically at the person and asking, what is it going to take you to really be a productive member of society? And so while Joe Holland would say that there are biblical principles that undergird a lot of those principles, it's not necessary, obviously, to be a follower of Jesus or to be a believer to embrace these. And so Cal and others are very sensitive in terms of we desire that persons become holistically equipped. And as they desire, they can be a part of a Bible study or something else.
Right.
But that surely isn't a requirement.
Right. But there is kind of a requirement to look at the problems holistically in terms
That's right.
of their view of life, their role in the
sure.
world, their responsibility, keeping others accountable to them,
exactly.
learning to put some limits on your passions or your or your addictions and things that are that may get you down.
It naturally leads to asking and answering some of the ultimate questions. And so that's a context where that can happen, but it's not an agenda item
right.
that is there.
Right. Right. I'm going to cut to a song now, partly because it captures, I think you suggested a few songs, and one of them is In Christ Alone. And I think that captures, from my point of view, your centeredness in Christ's work, but also your confidence with which you can reach out to others that you're not ashamed to be with them and you're not embarrassed by them.
Strength, my song, this cornerstone, this solid ground, firm through the fiercest drought and storm. What heights of love, what depths of peace, when fears are stilled, when striving cease. My comforter, my all in all, here in the love of Christ stand. In Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God in helpless babe, this gift of love and righteousness, scorned by the ones he came to save, till on that cross. Bursting forth in glorious day, up from the grave he rose again. And as he stands in victory, since curse has lost its grip on me, for I am his and he is mine, bought with the precious blood. Thank you. life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. No power of hell, no scheme of man can ever pluck me from his hand till he returns or calls me home. Here in the power of Christ I'll stand.
Listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest for this hour is Chuck Tompkins. Chuck, can you just you've been a part of this community for 30 years as a minister with a congregation, a major congregation locally, and for 9 years doing a very your own ministry, your own interpretation of God's call in your life. How have you changed over the years? How has your way of being, working changed? What's happening with you?
Yeah, that's a penetrating kind of a question, Eric. And I think that if I were to, it's been an evolution in my own experience, spiritually and otherwise. I came from a very far to the right conservative background, and I'm grateful for the heritage and the foundation that I had both with my family, with education. And I would say that my time here in Ithaca has broadened my perspectives, and it has caused me to experience the richness of relationships and perspectives that are beyond my own. I think initially, in the developmental years, even postgraduate school and so on, I was somewhat intimidated by those who may have had different perspectives and even had somewhat of an edge, an attitude edge in terms of their own thinking and perspective. I think that what is cultivated for me, and probably it's been a part of the richness of the Bethel Grove community, which by intention and by design had a doctrinal statement, but it was not a tight doctrinal statement that excluded those who may have disagreed. Aside from the essentials of what we believe, there was area of disagreement, and mm-hmm. that cultivated an acceptance and an understanding of others and how they came at things. And so I think
disagreements that could be talked about, could be celebrated in community.
Right. So I think that was a helpful breeding ground for me. And then
I'm tempted to say how Ithaca of that, but
yeah, but you'll resist that.
No, not quite.
I mean, I've appreciated just being a part of the Main Line Pastors Fellowship, and I've so appreciated just cultivating those relationships across lines and theological spectrums that probably 20, 30 years ago, I don't think I ever would have moved into those kind of an arenas. And either that's the result of my own growing security in terms of what I believe and why, or it's a desire to really understand. I think it's both an understanding of how others come to how they believe what they do. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a real rich time for me to share in times of fellowship. And I'd love to give names, or I won't, but it's just been really terrific to understand how they have arrived at where they are and to build those personal relationships together.
And one of the I'm going to say this not for names, but, Chuck, you're the only one of two or three people who meet with both the evangelical clergy leaders and with the mainline Protestant, Christian, Catholic, Jewish, other religious leaders in town. You span boundaries that are often not spend, and also at both of the campuses, both colleges. So you're out there in a way with people who respect you and value your opinion and engage you, and you engage them across the board. That's almost unheard of here or anywhere.
Yeah, well, I think that probably for me, that has been a stretch for me to work that through. And whereas years ago I may have perceived that as being compromise, I've come to recognize that it's not compromise. And I think, Eric, some of your thinking in terms of shared journey has been helpful in that regard. where to engage persons who believe differently than I do is not a compromise. It's seeking to build a bridge of understanding.
Right.
And my perception many times of what a person believes is totally erroneous concerning what they really believe, because I have superimposed what I've been told a person may believe versus understanding them personally. What do you believe? And even in the dialogue of that conversation, it's not a matter of me giving up something, though I'm always open to why a person believes what they believe and recognizing I don't have a corner on all truth. Therefore, I want to be open to what others are saying and how they're saying it, and I can learn from them.
Right, and I want to do what I think is it will be a friendly interpretation of that word believe, which comes out of an evangelical tradition. It means also, what do you value and what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just an intellectual construct.
Right.
And so when people hear that term, oftentimes they don't get that it's who, what do you love, what do you value, and
sure.
what do you do?
Sure.
And when you can meet people there, you don't have to. It's often false if you try to create an agreement where there is one, where you compromise yourself, as you said.
Yeah, or where there isn't an agreement.
Right.
And I think that at the core of it as well is that I've got such a growing core respect for all persons who are made in the image of God, that that's the foundation for my respecting of a person. I may totally disagree with what they have to say and where they're coming from.
And you may get a little agitated about
and
that
agitated,
from time to time.
Sure, and even defensive.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I come to recognize that we have a shared core value as persons made in the image of God, and therefore that obligates me as well as gives me the desire to respect them, though I may totally disagree with the perspective from which they come.
Mm-hmm. You may not respect their opinions, but you will respect them as persons.
That's right.
And when they
sometimes that's a tough line to walk, and it can be misunderstood and misinterpreted, but that's at least what I strive for.
Right. Well, I think in this culture, one of the things that we forget is that just because I may love you or like you does not mean I endorse what you do.
Exactly.
And we have gotten so far from being able to be clear that I can enjoy your company and be completely at odds with you on all sorts of things. And would that we had this, our relationships at work or at home might be a whole lot more friendly and civil, but we don't.
Yeah.
And what I see you modeling in a community that this wider, you know, with 40-45% of local residents being non-religious or anti-religious, their stereotype often of the evangelical pastor, let alone evangelical pastor, is someone who's incredibly judgmental, and they've already responded defensively before a person like yourself has had a chance to get a word out of your mouth, and yet you have met what has been some bad behavior on the part of the evangelical leadership of this country and tried to show, hey, you know, we're not as we are necessarily painted to be. We are people too, and we want to get to know you.
Yeah. Well, many times we have earned the reputation that we have, even though there's a flip side to that, and there's much that has happened historically as well as presently that evangelicals don't get credit for because
right.
it's clouded over by the other stuff.
Right.
But
right.
that's why and reason why I really appreciate that song that you played in Christ Alone, because as I talk to students or even others, and they ask me, if anyone does ask me the question, are you a Christian? I don't respond affirmingly. I usually say, well, you need to tell me what you mean by that term, and then I'll tell you whether
I am
or not.
You've done that to me, too.
Because for me, Christianity has got some bad press, but Christ, when you ask
some legitimately bad press.
Exactly. But when you ask the average person, what do you think of Jesus? The overwhelming response is positive. And so I'd much rather be labeled as I'm seeking to be a follower of Jesus versus I'm a Christian. Now, that may be a matter of semantics, but I find that it's a conversation stopper if I simply use the terminology that inflames or has
right.
a history to it.
Right.
So I'm more interested in what does a person think concerning Jesus, and let that be the focus of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And it is a way that it invites exploration. What does that mean?
Exactly.
And yes. And one of the things that I would want to kind of follow up was as you have kind of moved into these other environments or welcomed relationships with people of different religious faiths, or atheists or non-religious folks, how have you felt I mean, one of the hurdles that I think people who have a strong sense of righteousness and justice is that when they begin to feel compromised or the fear of compromise, they begin to shut down. And you don't feel compromised anymore by building relationships with other people that you see as in the image of God. How does it feel? How did you have to change your feelings about people or become more aware of this image? What happened to change the way you feel?
Well, I think that as an evangelical, if I could use that label, mm-hmm. as a person who's a follower of Jesus, that Jesus made it really clear before he left the earth that I want you to go and I want you to make disciples. And so I am under the obligation of what has been called the Great Commission, make disciples of all nations, or to invite persons to consider who I am. And so a part of the warp and woof of my own belief system is to present Jesus in such a way that persons are going to be drawn toward him. Now, it's not my responsibility at all to draw somebody towards Jesus. It's not my responsibility, let's use the inflammatory word, to proselytize.
Right, right. But what is it about your relationship with Jesus that gives you the confidence to feel that you have something worth sharing?
Well, if Jesus is lifted up as the person who he says he is and who he is, then he says, I'm going to draw persons to myself. And so as a man historically and presently, mm-hmm. he's a glorious person. He's a beautiful person. His reputation is there in the pages of Scripture and so on. So it's got nothing to do with me or my security. It's simply, does a person see clearly who Jesus was mm-hmm. and who he is? And so it's not a matter of how do I feel if a person responds negatively to what I've said, because there is a sense in which the cross and what Jesus has come to say, the message of the cross and what is required of that is offensive. Mm-hmm. But I don't want my presentation of Jesus to be offensive. I don't want what I believe to be offensive.
Right, right, right. You want to make the help cut through people's assumptions.
Exactly.
To get to what you see
right.
as the core.
Right.
And my question is, it's not even so much, it is a question, but it's also an observation, is that the people who can do what you're doing with the most integrity have some deep personal relationship with that historical figure or their emotional and intellectual relationship with that spiritual relationship with that figure that compels them to want to share the good that they've come to know.
Sure.
The beauty.
Sure.
And I was just asking, how do you experience that being of Jesus that you so much want to share?
Yeah, well, it's like one of my mentors said to me, we're simply a couple of beggars who have discovered where we found bread. And so you simply want to share that with someone else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think that when Jesus says, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly, and we have been the recipients of that life, that it's natural that I'm going to share and desire to share it with someone else. Whether that's on any scale, if someone, regardless of their belief system, has found the next diet that is the best thing or whatever else they discover, they want to share it with their friends. That's just natural.
Right.
And so I think that the naturalness with which I can talk about Jesus and talk about the change that he's affecting in my life and what he's done for me is just an overflow in terms of what's happening in my life and a desire to share it with others.
And I think that in a community like Ithaca, where we are so diverse that oftentimes the compromise is that we're afraid to talk about anything, because if we're excited about any one thing, we are afraid that we'll be perceived as coercing or imposing upon others, or we genuinely want to change them. So there's that too.
Yeah.
But I think if we can, and one of the reasons why you received the Multi-Faith World Award for working across differences is that you hold your own as a Christian in relationship with others who are not sharing what you've known, but not coercing them in any way mm-hmm. to know anything other than what you've simply presented by way of friendship, by way of commitment and modeling the best you know.
Well, and none of us likes to be coerced, whether it be a political situation or whatever it is. I mean, that's just anti-human.
And it's the condition in which our political system operates now, right. And many of our congregations, in either an implicit or explicit sense of coercion to be inside the boundaries, and it is tragic.
It is, and I think that regardless of religious perspectives, whether it be political or any other kind of discussions, we know what it's like to be around obnoxious people, and we know what it's like to be coerced or to be boxed in or to be stereotyped and so on. So, you know, I just refuse to play that kind of a game. And if a person tells me that you're seeking to proselytize me, my classic response is, the Bible tells me very clearly that I'm not allowed to do that. That's the work of God's Spirit.
Right. And
I am simply an agent. I am simply a vehicle. I am only a messenger. I can only tell you as a beggar where I found bread. It's up to you whether you want to discover that bread or not.
Right. And because of the institutional history of coercion behind big institutions, it's hard for people to take that as an honest statement, but we need to kind of meet each other where those honest statements apply. Also, what I've learned in my own life is that there's a certain amount of me when I come up against prejudice and I kind of take a defensive stance towards it. When I was in seminary, I didn't really go to seminary to be ordained a Christian minister. But I discovered that in New York City, among a lot of openly hostile anti-religious folks in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, that I almost felt compelled to be ordained just to show that somebody can be smart and scientific in orientation as well as deeply Christian all at the same time, as a way to just kind of get in their faces. But that was my young rebellious side, and there are costs in doing that.
There's costs, but there's also assets.
And I'm comfortable playing that as long as I can maintain my sense of humor.
Sure.
And if you lose your sense of humor in any of this, it's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's gone. Yeah. So, in your reaching out to work to get to know other people, as you had said, and as being in the image of God, all persons. What have you come to know about working with others that you didn't know before you started this more explicit relationship building?
Well, I think that what I really come to acknowledge is that everyone has a contribution that they can make in a community and to a society, regardless of their religious perspective. I probably naively thought that the best persons that can make a contribution to a society are those who've been really under the process of being changed by God Himself. Mm-hmm. But there is a goodness that is a part of humanity that still is laced with the same evil that all of us are, you know, as a part of our human nature.
An equal opportunity offenders that we are.
Yeah, there's a good way to put it. But I think that, I've come to see in a number of settings, persons who honestly are better citizens than some who are followers of Jesus. You know, some who may be atheists, but they've got a set of morals or ethics that may be even superior. That's a difficult thing for me to acknowledge and to see, but I also recognize that there are persons who, regardless of their persuasion spiritually, are just good people. I mean, and they love their wives, they love their families, they're just good people, and I've come to admire that in them and recognize that that's a full expression of the image of God in them, and some things that work in them, which I simply applaud and affirm and encourage, and from my own religious perspective, it's a goodness that is great for the society and great for humanity. But that's where Jesus comes in to take that goodness and to build upon it, or to even, could I say, exchange it for the goodness that he himself provides by a transformation of the deep person within. But I think that, Eric, that my years have given me a greater appreciation for the goodness of persons and their humanitarian efforts, and whether it be on a large scale or a small scale, our community is what it is by the pulling together of all community persons to become, you know, the community that it is. So,
Yeah, no, I hear you. And what I'm sensing is that truth is truth wherever it's found. That was there was a speaker at Cornell through Chesterton House. Mao, is I guess was his
name. Yeah, Richard Mao.
Richard Mao, talking about that as a way that you know you don't just because it's not allied with your particular religious group or tradition doesn't mean it's not truth or
right.
goodness.
Right.
And I think that is a consciousness that is beginning to become embraced by more and more people of what mm-hmm. we would call an evangelical tradition,
right.
which I think is an opening up that that hasn't made the news yet. But the other piece is that, and that some people have a hard time, is how you just described how when that truth or that goodness is brought into relationship with Jesus, you say it's kind of transformed into something more. And that's where people have a sticking point if they feel like what they have is compared to somehow less than what the more is. And I don't think that's exactly what you're saying, but there is a fullness in your practice that you would not know in theirs.
You're right.
So the way I take it, coming from a foot in the evangelical tradition, a foot in the mainline tradition, is that for you, Jesus is the most complete and whole and ultimate way of being human and related to the divine that's possible.
Right.
And the for you to truly truly experience something, it has to go through that that cleansing, evaluation, reflection, refiner's fire that comes with a relationship with
right,
Jesus.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, none of us is without, let me use a biblical term, which we don't use in our society anymore, is sin.
Yeah.
Even with our innate goodness, there is still this core rebellion that I have towards God. And that's why, from my perspective, Jesus came to this earth to rescue me from the consequences of my own choices. And therefore, he said, when he says, I've come that you might have life, it's a clear inference, is that though I may feel like I've got life, there is another dimension of life that I don't have, I'm not experiencing.
Right.
And so Jesus comes to rescue me from that and to give to me this new life that he has, which requires, as you suggest, this cleansing and the giving of this new life so that it affects me both now and for the hereafter.
Right, right. And I want you to be clear about how that standard of what I would call the gold standard, for lack of a better, the excellence of the whole excellence in your life, how that happens, I would want you to value that more than anything else that anybody else has. So when you make that comparison, I don't find it threatening. I want other people to stand as firmly in their convictions and in their values and say that, yes, I see the truth and I see good in what you're doing, but I need to put it through this strainer so that I understand and feel it, because that's the only way I can know it. And when you've come there, that's kind of like the bottom line for each of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's power there. We don't compromise each other. We just kind of sit back and say, whoa.
Right.
Something powerful is happening here. I want to go on that note to another one of your selections, which is Great is Thy Faithfulness, because I think what we're talking about at this moment is what it means to be faithful. This is in honor of all the college students you've ever worked with.
Thou hast been, thou forever wilt be. winter and springtime and harvest, sun, moon, and stars in their courses above, join with our nature in manifold witness to thy great faithfulness, mercy, and love. To cheer and to guide, strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow. Blessings all mine with 10,000 beside. Great is thy faithfulness, great is thy faithfulness.
Was Sam Robson with Great Is Thy Faithfulness, a recording that he made just last month. Chuck, this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest this hour is Chuck Tompkins. And Chuck, you know, I think the flip side of Great Is Thy Faithfulness, Lord, unto me, which is the line from that song, is how do we maintain our own try to maintain our own sense of equanimity, openness, engagement, willingness to do, willingness to step back when that's required. How do you maintain your center and your spirit and your hope, or how do you try?
I would think that I think the answer to that question is probably one of it's an ongoing evolution for me. I think that one of the downsides of having left formal pastoral ministry is, after 35 years, is adjusting my rhythm of life. One of the things I really miss about pastoral work was the discipline of study, mm-hmm. and having times of extended blocks of time to do study and reflection. I remember a prophet by Cornell said that there are some persons on this campus who get paid to think, and I thought, man, what a luxury to be able to get paid to think. And so I missed that aspect. Though I was very active in the church, it did give me those disciplined times to be in the scriptures and to do other reading.
And that little piece there, for a lot of people who do not know ministries, ministers who are not religious, there are many, many, many ministers, as there are rabbis or imams, who are deeply reflective people, and they historically were the ones where that kind of deep contemplation lived in the life of the community.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
yeah.
And you miss it.
Yeah, I miss it. And I know that during those times, I took maybe a 10-day solo time or a 3-day solo time and just disengaged. And I can understand the monastics and the desert fathers, why they did that. And I'd come away from those experiences and say, man, I am losing out by not making this more of a regular routine for myself. So since the years that I've been gone, I've struggled to find that right rhythm, and I think that there are times when I can see some of the edges around my life are getting frayed, and there's a correspondence to the lack of what we would call spiritual disciplines to either the triggers in my own life that may result in inappropriate responses and impatience with a granddaughter, or my lack of patience with my wife, or other relationships. And so when I see those triggers being triggered, then it becomes symptomatic that I need to tend to my soul. I need to take an inner look at what's not happening in my inner world. And so I try to be in the discipline of daily time in the scriptures, daily time in prayer, reflecting on what I am reading and studying, and trying to do some other reading as well. But I would say that those become rich in terms of soul restoration. And honestly, I think that there are persons in other spiritualities and religious systems that probably exceed that discipline better than I do, whether it be in meditative practices, whether it be times of solitude, because I think we all recognize there is an immaterial part of my life that it's so easy to get caught up in the physical, to get caught up in the emotional, in the busyness of life, the freneticness of life, and all the demands, that we really don't care for our inner gardens or our inner souls. And as a result, we're impoverished. And I've said many times that I'm experiencing a leanness of soul. And so to respond to that in an appropriate way means to get back to those spiritual disciplines, whether it be fasting, whether it be prayer, whether it be silence, whether it be solitude, because there's a richness about those which I need to continue to cultivate. I think we all do, in order to be the rich kind of a persons that that God has designed us to be.
Now my guests oftentimes kind of vary between those who try to do it on a daily, these sorts of disciplines on a daily basis, and those for whom that kind of a regimen is too rigid, and those who try to notice when things are slipping out of balance, and then they bring them in to right them. And you seem to be kind of right in the middle.
Yeah, I'm probably in the middle on that
right
one.
In the middle.
Yep.
Specifically. Where do you take yourself, your inner thoughts or physically, when you need to do a kind of a spiritual timeout, a soul cleansing, or whatever you want to call it?
Well, in this beautiful part of the country, there's nothing for me like a good long walk outdoors. And I love nature. I just love the outdoors. And there's something about being alone in a forest that is soul rejuvenation for me. And so to be outside looking at a waterfall, I mean, Jesus spent a lot of time by the water, and he's had good reason. He made it. He designed. He might as well enjoy it. But there's something about the great outdoors that just cultivates that kind of an attitude. So, and if I can't do that, then I've got a chair that I use, and in the quiet of the morning, that becomes a place of solitude and reflection, though it's not usually long enough. But I try to find those spaces. And even, honestly, there's some restaurants in town where I go for coffee, and I've got a corner, and that's a place. There's a sacred place, even in a very public place, that I can wall myself out, and I can feel like I get in touch.
Right. And what you're just saying there, the spiritual disciplines, or any physical discipline, is once you've made it repetitive enough, your body and everything remembers. So once you do it, it starts to carry you long. It may not be long enough.
Right.
But you get an extra benefit for having done it
over and over
again. Chuck, it's great to talk with you today.
Oh.
Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you, Eric. I appreciate it. It's good talking with you, and thank you for your stimulating questions and your perspectives.
And this has been the Made of Clay Report, and our closing selection is one that Chuck picked from Handel's Messiah. It's the Hallelujah Chorus.
Hallelujah!